For the past few weeks, my Facebook feed has been a near constant stream of pictures taken in apple orchards and pumpkin patches. Yes, it's that time of year when city folk like to get muddy for a day. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard here on KCUR is a food show. We'll start in the fields where those apples and pumpkins grow, then we'll head to the kitchen to make something sweet. Pretty soon, the food critics will be here to help us find the best desserts in town. I can't wait. For now, what about those apple orchards and pumpkin patches? Most of us go for an hour or two. We find that perfect pumpkin, head home, carve our jack-o'-lanterns, and forget about it until next year. But not Frank Geringer. This is his life and livelihood at Geringer's Family Orchard and Berry Farm in Edgerton. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning to you, too. This is a big time of year for you, right?
Yes, it is a busy time of year.
So thanks for stepping away from the fields. Have you already been out working on stuff this morning?
Not this morning.
What time do you usually get started?
We usually start between 6 and 7.
What do you have to do to get your orchard and pumpkin patch ready for visitors?
A lot of groundskeeping, includes mowing, you know, getting things presentable for the public, trying to put on a fresh face each day. We're at the last weekend of pumpkin season, so things tend to look a little tired. We try to focus on keeping things. So the person that comes the last day of the season has a fresh appearance as the one that comes the first day of the season.
It seems like the business of farming, just the nature of that work, the sunrise to sunset aspect of farming would be hard to squeeze in all the stuff you have to do to make it possible for people to step in and visit. Like, it's not always presentable work is my understanding.
Right. A lot of it's dirty. It's hard work. It's outside. Most everything's physical. There's very little mechanized things to help you get prepared. So a lot of it's just learning to deal with help. We employ a lot of high school and college kids, so we have a lot of help. It's not a totally all-consuming process.
What do you do the rest of the year when people aren't just out at the pumpkin patch getting ready for Halloween? Because that is just a moment in a calendar.
Right. Our off-season would consist mainly in pruning. We have over 10 acres of peach trees. Those require a lot of pruning in the wintertime. Also, blueberries require a lot of pruning. We're covering strawberries, preparing for early May, late April is when our strawberry season starts. So there's always something going on.
How much of your business would you say is growing food, and how much of it is what is now known as agritourism?
We are just kind of getting started into the agritourism. So I would say probably 80 to 90% of our production is still growing something and selling that produce.
How did you get into growing food? I mean, has this been a long-standing family business?
No, it's not. Actually, I grew up in town, which is kind of unusual. I started with some hogs, working for a gentleman in high school that helped get me started, and things kind of evolved. At one time, we raised a lot of hogs, raised enough corn to feed those hogs. Since then, we've gotten pretty much out of the livestock end of things, gotten more into our row crops, and then a few years ago in the early 2000s, we planted some trees and became interested in specialty production. So we do fruit, we do strawberries, blueberries, peaches, blackberries, sweet corn, and we have high tunnel tomatoes. So it's been a way for us to diversify the farm. It's been a way for our family to actually come back to the farm. Our son has just recently joined us. My wife has quit her job in town and works full-time on the farm. So it's let us diversify without actually having to buy some expensive property. We're doing high-value crops on the property that we have rather than trying to buy more property to grow more corn or soybeans, which is basically a bulk commodity.
So the fruit is of more value per item?
Yes, per item, per acre. You can generate fairly large amounts of gross income off a fairly small acreage, whereas corn or soybeans, really you just have to keep increasing acreage if you want to increase your income. This lets us not chase that and do specialty products, yeah.
Is that kind of the deal with agritourism as well? I mean, you wouldn't have to add land for that either.
Exactly. Agritourism is a really exciting a term that's kind of came on to the forefront here lately. It lets a lot of farms share with the public an actual working farm. You invite the public out. It could be a bed and breakfast. It could be a farm-to-field dinner. It could be a pumpkin patch. It could be a U-Pick experience with your grandkids. So there's lots of things that encompass that agritourism title, and it's a way to diversify income.
Other than the the pumpkin patch, well, do you do a lot of those other things you just named?
We focus, our farm focuses on U-Pick opportunities for fresh fruit. We try to sell everything we raise right off the farm U-Pick. We start in the spring with strawberries, then we go into June with blueberries, then we go into July and August with blackberries and peaches.
But you've also done something that you call agrotainment?
Well, agrotainment and agritourism are somewhat interchangeable terms. Agritainment would be fun farm experiences. We have, like, for example, if you come out to our pumpkin patch, we have what we call the corn pit. It's a large 40 by 40 tent. It has 3x3, the giant round or the giant square bales around the outside. We fill it with corn, about 2 foot deep, has well over 1,000 bushels of corn in it. It's fun for the kids to play in. It's entertaining, but yet it's also agriculture-based. We actually grow the corn that's in the pit. We grow thousands and thousands of bushels of corn each year. So it's something fun for the kids to do. It's entertainment. It's not really carnival-type entertainment, but it's still entertainment.
This is going to sound weird, but have you ever gotten in the corn pit yourself?
Yes.
What does it feel like? Because it seems like I'm imagining uncooked corn, and it's kind of like...
Well, they're hard kernels.
Right.
They're dried hard. We have a lot of parents get in there. It's a lot of fun. In fact, some days we have maybe as many parents as we do kids. Some of the women like to sit in there, and they take their shoes off and say it's like a massage, like a foot massage. It's really, if you've never been in it, it's really relaxing. It's kind of a fun experience. The kids swim in it. They make corn angels, like a snow angel, out of the corn, and they dive off the sides into it. It's really a lot of fun.
Is this a popular trend, or did you make it up?
No, it's the corn pit has been around for a little while. We certainly didn't invent it, but larger and larger corn pits seem to be really popular. It's one of the most popular kids' activities on the farm.
What about corn mazes? Have you done that?
Yes, we have a corn maze. It's approximately 4 acres. It's an interactive corn maze. It's actually educational. When you get there, you'll get a game sheet. You have 8 stations that you find that are basically lost in the maze that you find. So it's a lot of fun.
Other than this just being a source of revenue for you and kind of a fun thing for people to do on a Saturday when they're not busy with something else, I mean, why do you think agritourism exists, or like, why do you do it? Is there a reason beyond those things I just mentioned?
Well, one, agritourism is a way for people that live or reside in the city to get in touch with the farm. We're about 3 generations away from the farm now. Most people don't have a relative that lived on the farm. If you go back to when I was a kid, which wasn't all that long ago, but we always had a grandparent or somebody we knew that lived on the farm. You went to grandma's house for Thanksgiving. They lived out on the farm.
But over the river and through the woods.
Exactly. Most people don't have that opportunity anymore. So even if it's just for a couple hours, they can bring their kids out. They can pick a peach off the tree. They can pick a strawberry. The kids get to know that it doesn't come out of a can from the local grocery store, that does actually grow somewhere.
With all the kinds of fruit you do grow, it seems surprising to me that you don't grow apples. I mean, that is such a popular thing to have grown this time of year in this part of the country. You do peaches and berries. It seems like this would fit right into your business model with all the agritourism. People love to go and pick apples.
It will, and we're in the process of planting some apples. The reason we never focused on fall things or apples or this pumpkin patch is our first year is the fact that my wife worked for the school district, and when she did that, we picked summertime, the heat of summer fruits. So we were done by Labor Day when school started. Now that she's home, we have time to do the pumpkin patch, focus on some more fall stuff, and we intend on doing some trellised apples for you pick exactly.
What is it? I mean, your choice of peaches is sort of adventurous for Kansas.
It's very adventurous. Peaches are a high-risk crop in Kansas. they can do very well here, but they're very hit and miss. A lot of years we'll lose them to frost or cold winter temperatures, but the years that they do, they're really popular. People drive for hours to come purchase fresh peaches right off the tree.
Why do you think that is, as opposed to just going to the grocery store where they're going to come in constantly from Georgia?
Right. The thing with peaches is Georgia grows great peaches, so does California. The thing with the peach is, the longer you leave that peach on the tree, the better it becomes. It continues to increase its sugar content each day. If I can leave that peach on that tree 3 to 4 days longer than California or Georgia, it's going to taste much, much better than a store-bought peach. The reason they pick them early is because they have to ship them hundreds, if not thousands of miles. They have to pick them when they're hard and green so they're not bruised by the time they get to the store. To enjoy a true peach that's going to run down your elbow with that juice, you've got to have a fresh one that's fully tree ripened.
Man, you just made me hungry for a fresh peach, and it is not the season. Right now, it is the season for pumpkins, which you do grow, and I assume that while everyone's coming there to get a pumpkin for a jack-o'-lantern, you're growing it as a crop. I mean, what do you like to do with a pumpkin? Make jack-o'-lanterns or pumpkin pie?
I love pumpkin pie. That's about all we do with them. I'm not a big jack-o'-lantern carver myself, but my grandkids sure love to carve on them.
Well, Frank Geringer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you got a pumpkin out at the pumpkin patch, you're probably using it to make a jack-o'-lantern. But if you've just come back from the apple orchard, you might be getting tired of applesauce right about now. So let's stop in on pastry chef Jessica Armstrong at the restaurant Novel on the West Side. She's using locally sourced apples for her take on a traditional fall dessert.
This is a fried apple pie. It is coated in a miso butterscotch. It's coming with a cinnamon ice cream. My grandmother taught me how to bake when I was very young. I loved apples. I've made pie my whole life, and fried pies are pretty delicious, especially in the fall when it starts getting colder outside. I think it's common in the South. What? McDonald's. McDonald's has their famous fried pies.
Is that where you got your inspiration?
No. So this is the fried pastry dough. And you roll it out pretty thin. Then I make an apple filling. It's apples, cinnamon. They're the gala apples from the crumbs. A little bit of lemon juice and brown sugar. And then just stuff it in the dough and then crimp it and then fry it. So it's fried to order. And then dipped in a miso butterscotch sauce.
That was Jessica Armstrong making fried apple pie at Novel. Jenny Vergara of Feast Magazine is one of our food critics here on Central Standard, and her buddies will join us shortly to search out the best desserts in town. But Jenny, what are some other great ways of using apples in a dessert?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, who doesn't love a fried hand pie, right, that Jessica was making? I mean, that's the premier. But, you know, apple pie is part of our American heritage. But there's also like an apple turnover cake that you can get it's a lovely French delicacy. So you basically bake it kind of right side up and then you flip it over and the bottom is all caramelized and you serve it basically. So it's like an upside down, I guess, apple cake. You can make apple butter or apple sauce and use that in any number of cakes to make it more moist and also bring a lot of flavor, a lot of the kind of winter herbs and spices kind of into the mix. But, you know, you can even put it over ice cream, honestly. So, I mean, I think there's a plethora of ways to use, obviously, the seasonal fruit.
Would apple cider alongside these desserts be overkill?
Oh, I, you know, I don't think so. I mean, why not? You know, just a little bit of same, I think never hurt anybody. But yeah, no, I mean, apple cider is another, you can make an apple cider float if you wanted to. So yeah, I know. I mean,
yum.
It's it's never any. I mean, if you talk about cinnamon ice cream in apple, you know, in an apple cider, I think that would be a delicious float. So
I am having that this weekend, Jenny. What do you think of frying apple pie? That is like double Midwestern. I feel like it's the country fair meets grandma's kitchen.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. I mean, we love everything fried for sure, and it is part of kind of our heritage. You know, there's nothing not to like about something that's crispy and crunchy on the outside, and then you bite into it and you've got this delicious kind of warm, you know, apple, cinnamon, nutmeg, you know, a little spice in there. It's delicious.
And those are sort of like, that's the constellation of spices that generally goes with apple. Is there anything, do you like to put anything kind of unexpected with the apple flavor, or do you like to stick with that cinnamon, nutmeg, et cetera?
You know, one of the spices that I just am loving right now, I'm kind of putting it in everything, is cardamom. And it's a little bit of a more exotic spice, but it has definitely kind of a citrus or fruit note to it in the spice. And I just think that it brings out the most wonderful. It's almost like black pepper and orange and lemon kind of all combined in a spice. I love the smell of it. I love it. I've been putting it in almost everything that I've been making lately. So I cardamom.
It's very warm and kind of grounding.
Mm-hmm. I think so too, but unexpected. You can definitely pick it out. So it's one of those kind of unusual that has people going, what is that?
Well, are you surprised to see something like the fried apple pie on a menu at a pretty upscale restaurant like Novel?
Oh, no. You know, I think we've always had a interest in nostalgic desserts, for sure. And I think this falls right into that. So anything comforting is going to fit right in. So
when we return, the best desserts in Kansas City. Call in with your favorite, 816-235-2888. The rest of our food critics will be right in the studio. I'm Gina Kaufman. KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. It's Friday, and the food critics are here on KCUR Central Standard. Today's theme is dessert. I'm Gina Kaufman, and the food critics are Charles Ferruza, whose work appears in The Independent and Shawnee Mission Post. Hi, Charles.
Hello, Gina.
And Mary Block. She writes all about her food adventures at Around the Block. That's her blog. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
We've also got Jenny Vergara with us. We were just talking to her about apples. She joins us from Feast Magazine.
Hello. Good morning.
So, you guys, I want to talk to you a little bit about trends in dessert before we dive into some of the favorites that you've brought in to recommend. Jenny, you've got, I think, a really interesting point to make about how desserts have changed in restaurants over the years.
Yeah, you know, in doing research for the show today, it really occurred to me, I thought, the way we eat desserts, or the way desserts are presented to us in restaurants, has really changed based on how we have utilized restaurants. So it used to be, back in the day, you'd go out to eat and it was a special occasion. And of course you would have dessert with that because you were treating yourself. You didn't go out to eat as much. Nowadays, you know, for convenience factors and many other reasons, we go out to eat an awful lot more as a society. And so dessert, you know, you don't want dessert every day. You can't have dessert every day, right? You're trying to watch your waistline or eat healthier.
I'm sure some people eat dessert every day, but not most of us.
Right, right. I mean, I think it's one of those things where the restaurants have responded by saying, we don't want to lose the opportunity to sell someone a dessert, so we'll make them smaller, or we'll make them shareable, or we'll, you know, truly make them something that you just can't say no to, because it's just a bite of something and you can't say no to that. So,
but that being said, Jenny, and I agree with you on that, two things. One is that desserts are a high profit margin for any restaurant.
Agreed.
A very high profit margin.
Agreed.
And, Seasons 52 has those little small desserts. Mm-hmm. I have yet to taste one that I've liked. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the fact that, you know, I don't feel guilty eating one of them. Mm-hmm. They're like served in a shot glass.
Right.
But I'd rather have a dessert that tastes good than good for me.
Is it like a Yoda type do or do not, there is no try kind of thing?
I think you're right.
They just need to add 100 more calories to each of those.
And on kind of going what Jenny said is that when I did some research on the restaurant at Union Station, the Harvey House, the desserts that they served 100 years ago or more, because it opened about 100 years ago, were very old-fashioned desserts. They were pies and cakes. They were, you know, they were not novelty kind of desserts.
But when did the novelty dessert become popular then, like things that are sort of torched tableside and that sort of thing?
Oh, that was, I would say the highlight of that was the 50s and 60s for sure. I mean, and they were desserts that you wouldn't do at home. So you were going out to eat for a special occasion and they would bring out the baked Alaska or they would flambe tableside.
What is a baked Alaska?
I actually made one for my birthday last year and there's pictures on Instagram of my terrible, melty,
you know, I was telling Jenny, there's a reason that baked Alaska has not really had a huge revival. It's not a very, I don't think it's a very good dessert. It's ice cream with meringue that's got liquor put on it to flambe it. It's a real showy dessert, but it's not.
And there's some cake in there too.
You know, there's cake in there, and it's not especially a memorable dessert.
It doesn't really cohesively hold together, in my opinion. I mean, if the ice cream's too hard or the cake's too dry at the bottom, so you have to kind of get all the pieces firing. But I've yet to have a delicious one, which is why I tried to make my own for my birthday last year.
We should say that there is a restaurant right now in Kansas City in the metro that is serving baked Alaska, which is very weird because you never see it on a dessert menu anymore, I think for good reason. And that is Sea Frogs in Prairie Village, the restaurant that used to be Standee's.
I think Howard at the Rigger did like a mini version of one for a while. I don't know that it's still on his dessert menu, but I think he had a baked Alaska for a while in his.
I'd rather, you know, if I'm like going to have an ice cream dessert, just give me a fudge sundae.
Well, I truly think that's where we're at, is that we want something comforting. I mean, if we're going to have the calories, we want something that we're going to enjoy from the first bite to the last bite.
So it sounds like we don't need to be impressed by our desserts anymore. We just need them to kind of do the trick to satisfy the sweet tooth at the end of the meal.
Exactly. Although, have you noticed that trends seem to be turning faster and faster and faster?
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, now,
what's right now?
What's right now? Well, I'm glad the donut hole trend is over. I'm sick of that. And I'm glad that I think the red velvet trend is pretty much over. And I'm glad the s'more trends is over. What is the trend of the moment, though?
I think bread pudding. I'm just going to say it.
Bread pudding is such an easy grab for anybody who serves a bread basket. I mean, if you have leftover bread in the restaurant, it's a wonderful way to use it.
If you make it correctly, yeah.
I just don't like the texture. Yeah. Doesn't do anything for me.
Well, and it can be crunchy on top, but
It's technically old bread.
I think,
let's be honest.
I think to Charles's point, the reason why trends are changing faster is the internet. I mean, chefs, just like all of us, have access to the internet now, and they're getting inspired by people that are doing things in New York and California and other places in the world. So it's a much smaller world that we live in now, which is why it's changing so quickly.
All right. Well, let's start getting some recommendations. You can call us with your favorite dessert in or around Kansas City at 816-235-2888. We'll be compiling an incredibly indulgent list, and we'd like to include your recommendation on it. Again, that number is 816-235-2888. Charles, what is a dessert you would like to tell us about that we can find?
Well, first, I want to give a shout out to to the last restaurant that I know of in Kansas City that still has a dessert cart where they roll out the cart, which, of course, would be Jasper's. Jasper still is using the same dessert cart for when they had the fancy restaurant on 75th Street. And it's a 5-shelf dessert cart, always a little bit wobbly, but that's one of the things I love about it. And it has 12 desserts on it. And they're all, except for one, desserts that I really, really like tartufo or coconut cake or their strawberry borghese cake. The dessert, of course, I don't like is cannoli, which makes me, you know, a really rotten Italian-American.
Why don't you like cannoli? You just don't?
I've never liked it. For one thing, it's a dessert made with cheese, and I don't mind cheese if it's in a cheesecake. I don't like it in anything else.
But wait, have you tried his cannoli cake?
You know what? I've wanted to.
It
I heard
looks
it's great.
Amazing. And I've seen it in person. I couldn't get it. I was on my way to somewhere else when I was in there talking to Jasper, but it looks really good. So if you're not a fan of the cannoli, you need to try the cannoli cake.
He also is, I think, the only restaurant in Kansas City right now that serves a chocolate mayonnaise cake.
Whoa.
Which is the most moist chocolate cake you could have in town.
So Charles Ferruzza is recommending most of the dessert cart at Jasper's.
Except one.
The cannoli.
Yeah. And, Jasper's does still serve spumoni, another Italian dessert I don't like. You know, obviously, you know.
Wait, you don't like spumoni?
No.
Charles.
You know, all I could think of, Gina, is that my father dragged us to more C-rated Italian restaurants in my hometown of Indianapolis. And spumoni was all you could get.
Mm-hmm.
So I hate spumoni, and I've never developed a taste for cannoli. I mean, I'd rather eat a Little Debbie snack cake. What does that say about me?
Wow.
Horrible.
Okay, that all being said, Charles does love the dessert cart at Jasper's.
I have eaten every single thing, not at once, on that dessert cart, and I love everything. The coconut cake is my favorite. I could eat an entire coconut cake there.
Okay. Yeah. I might try to witness that sometime.
I'd have to fast for a few weeks, but
So Mary, where do you want to take us for dessert?
Well, since it's National Chocolate Day and chocolate is my favorite kind of dessert, I think that's where I'll start. I love the chocolate budino at Cafe Sebastian.
What is a budino?
Well, if you picture rich chocolatey goodness in a loaf pan, and then it's sliced in a square, and it's flourless, thick, rich, dense, fudgy, fabulous. And she always has a few berries or whatever with it. And flourless chocolate cake is my thing.
But let's not kid ourselves. This is about the chocolate.
Exactly. But it is my favorite chocolate dessert in town.
And that's at Cafe Sebastian?
In the Kemper.
Mm-hmm. It's cakey instead of more like pudding?
No, it's more like a brownie than cake.
See, I think of budino as being a pudding.
It's supposed to be.
You know what? Typically it is, yeah. But she calls it a budino.
But you're absolutely right. Molten chocolate cake?
No, it is.
Another trend I'm glad to see going away.
Really think of a chocolate flourless cake
okay. In
a thin square.
Got it. All right.
Flat, like a loaf pan, like you're having banana bread, only it's all chocolate.
Brownies.
Like a brownie.
Mm.
But you're right. Typically, if you hear the word budino, you're thinking
I wondered
caramel pudding or something.
Yeah, gotcha.
Well, as long as we're talking about chocolate, I do think there's a bit of a polarizing effect that chocolate can have on a dessert menu, because there are the people who want to see something described as sinful that has like chocolate with chocolate plus some more chocolate on it. And then there are people who feel, I think, you know, a little goes a long way, or even maybe like there's a trend toward, you know, sophistication equals a non-chocolate dessert.
I'm in the former category. More is better.
Well, I think any dessert menu should have one chocolate dessert. And I am very wary of a dessert menu that doesn't have anything chocolate on it.
Why?
Because I think they're cheating a huge part of the population. I mean, I think people expect to see something chocolate on a dessert menu. I could be wrong about that.
No, I totally agree. I mean, it's been a staple. The molten chocolate lava cake that we were joking about earlier.
Right.
I mean, it has been ubiquitous on menus. It has been poked fun of in the movie Chef. I mean, we've seen a lot of the molten chocolate lava cake, and that's kind of where I think all of this stems from. But
Jenny, what do you like for dessert?
I am not a chocolate person. It's not to say I don't love chocolate. I like eating chocolate. So like a really good piece of chocolate I enjoy eating. But for my dessert, like an overall dessert, I tend to gravitate more toward kind of the caramels and the vanillas. That's kind of my sweet spot there.
So take us somewhere. Give us a recommendation.
Well, so I'm going to do a little bit of kind of a childhood throwback. And this is going to be Mary's new favorite dessert. She doesn't know it yet. But I'm chocolate-covered
french fries.
You're really close. You're really close. I'm going to sell her on it right now. So I was enjoying dinner at Sava and sitting next to Howard Hanna. And he said, you need to come by and see this new dessert we're doing at the Rieger, which is their shake and frites. So it's a play on steak and frites, right? And it's basically a shake that's made with the Cafe Amaro, the J. Rieger and Company's new kind of coffee liqueur. And it's just this boozy coffee-flavored chocolate with malt shake that comes. And then at the bottom of it, there are salty, hot Sava French fries, crispy, all around the bottom of it. And they're made to dunk in the shake like you would your fries in your Frosty at Wendy's.
So this is taking the savory, sweet thing. I mean, we've seen plenty of sea salt on a dessert, and this is sort of taking it the next level. I mean, it's forget about the salt, just bring the whole French fry.
Well, this is that, you know, this is a teenage, you know, childhood throwback for a lot of people is dipping their fries in their shake. And so this was a really delicious, delightful experience. It's not too big. It's a smaller, you know, a smaller shake that comes out. And with all the French fries piled at the bottom, you don't get a big ton, but you know, enough where you can really enjoy from the start to the finish this dessert. And it's really, really good.
I typically dip my French fries in ketchup, but that sounds like it's worth trying, especially because I love coffee milkshakes.
See, you know, I was going to say.
And, you know, tomato is a fruit, so ketchup is a fruit. Yeah.
Well, and I was lucky because I was sitting at the bar when I enjoyed it, and I had the opportunity to taste the Cafe Amaro plain before I tasted it in the milkshake. And it really is, I mean, if you're looking for a good coffee liqueur, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's very good.
So this is on the Rieger menu right now. That menu changes a lot.
Yes, it is. It's on their new fall menu.
Okay. Well, let's talk with Alicia in Kansas City to see what she wants to recommend for dessert. Hi, Alicia.
Hello. I have small children, and so we frequently try to eat at home, don't get out much, but I found a place that has great food and an even better dessert, and I've started swinging by there on my way home at least once a week and eating their flan. And it is Maya's Bakery in Riverside, Missouri. I live north of the river, but I live about 15 minutes away. And I will go out of my way to go by there and pick some up and take it home.
What is so special about this flan?
Oh, it's just so sinfully wonderful. They have large portions. It is just amazing. It's so bad for you and so good.
Okay, so that's a shout out for a flan at Maya's Bakery in Riverside. Apparently worth a trip out of your way on your way home, even for someone who doesn't go out much for food. But okay, flan as a dessert option. Critics?
I actually prefer flan to creme brulee.
I was going to say, creme brulee is always the classic, and flan tends to kind of get lumped into it, but it's really its own separate beast. I mean, it has, you know, it's traditionally a Mexican dessert and quite easy to make and has kind of the lovely caramel sauce that...
It's lighter than a creme brulee.
Yeah, as you flip it over.
It's sort of an egg custard. It's like a variation of an old-fashioned, you know, dessert that people... that mothers, at least mine did, would make an egg custard if you were sick.
But I've never heard of this Maya's Bakery, so that's a good tip.
Any other flans to recommend in Kansas City?
You know, there seemed like flan was on every menu for so long, particularly in Mexican restaurants, but I don't know that I have one particular...
I think red velvet cake took it over.
Let's hear from Adonis in Kansas City.
Hi. My recommendation, I guess, today is... the crack pie at Graham and Dunn.
So not crack, but a crack pie.
It's called like cracked. it's like, I believe it's based off of a dessert that's coming from that came from Momofuku in New York. It's like brown sugar and butter and oatmeal, and it's just like it's so delicious.
Mary Block is nodding so enthusiastically right now.
I have made that cake, and it is from Momofuku.
It sounds delicious, Mary.
It's delicious. It takes like 2 days to make, and
really difficult. I've made it too.
Yeah. Wait, why is it so hard?
Well, it has all these stages to it. So if you could just do it all at once, it wouldn't be a big deal.
You have to bake a cookie, crumble it to make the crust, and that's day one. Then you have to find corn powder, like ground corn, like dried corn kernels that have been ground for the filling of the pie, which is very difficult to find.
And the filling, it sits in the refrigerator uncovered for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm,
but
right.
the upshot is it's really, really good. I made it for Thanksgiving about 2 or 3 years in a row. And then my kids said, you know what? This is just too sweet.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so we stopped making it, but you can only eat a little bit.
It reminds me an awful lot. It's like a cross between a custard pie and a honey pie. If anybody's ever had a honey pie, it's very similar to that, I think. And honey pies are much easier to make than crack pie. So.
What's a honey pie? Like a sugar cream pie?
The Rieger actually puts it on its menu. I found a recipe for it and made it and then realized the Rieger had it. It's delicious.
But before we abandon the crack pie, Adonis, you get it at Graham and Dunn. And can you tell us a little bit more about your experience eating this? Because we've talked a lot about making it, but I want to hear about the eating experience.
Well, the eating experience, like the first time I had it, I didn't exactly It tasted familiar, like something I'd had as a child, and I couldn't quite remember or figure out where this familiar taste had come from, and I still haven't figured it out. But it's like eating this, and because they pair it with like a little scoop of, I think it's vanilla bean ice cream, it tastes like brown sugar heaven, and it's just absolutely delicious. And I know, you know, every time I go by there, that's what I'm going to have. You know, I'm going to have that, and I'm going to have, like, you know, a 10-year crevassier or something like that with it. You know, it's absolutely delicious.
Well, it sounds like the addictive substance being referenced in the title is not entirely misplaced then.
That sounds delicious.
Yep.
Well, as long as we're on kind of classic tastes and things that harken back to childhood, Jenny, tell me about the oatmeal cream pie that you're recommending, because I'm guessing this is not the same as the Little Debbie's.
Yeah, so let's talk about... So now I'm going to sell this recipe to Charles, because this is going to be his new... If he likes Little Debbie's, this is going to be his new favorite.
I never liked the oatmeal cakes in Little Debbie's.
Oh, Charles. Work with me. All right, so this oatmeal cream pie is from Dolce Bakery, and I've been good friends with Erin for a long time, and I just think she does the best classic cookies and bars and cakes in Kansas City. Her bakery is in the Prairie Village Shops. And this oatmeal cream pie, I was in there for a totally different reason, saw it in the case, decided to treat myself, and it's really soft, delicious, lots of brown sugar, oatmeal cookie with raisins, golden raisins and dark raisins, and then it has cream filling with caramel on the inside.
Boy.
So that's it. Dolce Bakery?
Dolce Bakery.
All right. Well, we're going to get back with all of our critics' recommendations for desserts and yours at 816-235-2888 right after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. It's Friday. Our food critics are here. We've got Charles Ferruzza, Mary Block, and Jenny Vergara telling us about their favorite desserts. And we've been hearing from you, too, at 816-235-2888. Charles, you have a couple of go-to places for good desserts.
I do. I'm very, very fond of Cafe Europa in Crestwood.
What's so special about their desserts?
Well, they've got the lemon cake that... I didn't know it had controversy attached to it, but apparently it does. And right now for fall, I think they've got a warm plum cobbler that's really good.
Mm. Have you ever had their carrot cake cupcake? It's big. It almost looks like a mini cake.
Mary, you know I don't approve of cupcakes.
I know, but this is like a mini cake.
Briefly tell us why not.
Because cupcakes are all about icing and not about the cake.
And you're not an icing guy.
No, I'm not.
Okay, go on.
Well, it's like a mini cake, and it does have, unlike a cupcake, it has icing in the middle, too.
Oh, it does?
It does.
That's cool.
Yeah, and it's just really moist, good. Just what a carrot cake should be.
So Cafe Europa is getting high marks on dessert, sort of generally. And ignoring any controversy for the moment, you're a fan of the lemon cake, Charles?
I am, because it has a nice tartness to it. I don't like... lemon cakes that are too sweet. I like a little punch to it. I do want to say, though, the prettiest desserts you can find in Kansas City, and pretty is a big deal for dessert, I think, is...
That's why they came out on carts back in the day.
I know, if only they all still did. Andre's has such pretty desserts. You know, they're almost too pretty to eat, although I do eat them, but...
I cannot disagree with that. Absolutely stunning European pastries.
Andre's over in the South Plaza.
Yeah, I mean, they're like they should be painted.
Well, and the nice part now is they've got that cafe in the front, not just the restaurant in the back, but they've got that lovely kind of coffee shop, wine bar in the front where you can just go and have dessert and coffee or a glass of wine.
And Mary Block, you know, you've got some pies on your list. You've got also, you've mentioned a flourless chocolate torte, and you've got lots of chocolate desserts, which will appear online at kcur.org later today if we don't get to those. But what about your pie recommendations?
I love the pies at Rye. They have a Mocan pie, which is...
Is it like a molasses pie?
No, it's more like a pecan pie, okay. But the nuts are from Missouri and Kansas, pecans and walnuts. There's some chocolate. And Megan's crusts are so fabulous, too. And then I'm not a huge lemon meringue person, but if I'm going to eat it anywhere, that's where I want to have it. I don't know if she uses Meyer lemons in the lemons, but they're really tart, and it's just full of lemon flavor. And then there's Upper Crust Bakery, which always makes great pies. It's in Overland Park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the downtown Overland Park.
Yeah.
Let's hear from Joel in Kansas City. Hi, Joel.
Hey there. I just wanted to give a shout out to Jack Stack. Has an amazing house-made carrot cake. You're talking about carrot cake. It's just one of the best carrot cakes I've had. It has like a caramel sauce on top with these maple glazed pecans, I think it is, or walnuts scattered around it. And I just think it's to die for. It's a shareable cake as well.
Well, we don't usually think of barbecue places as destinations for dessert, but Joel is making a compelling case for the carrot cake at Jack Stack.
I can't disagree with him. It really is very good.
As long as we're on the topic of carrot cake, I want to talk with Pinky in Overland Park. Hi, Pinky.
Hi, how are you? I feel certain that a couple of your folks would have the recipe for carrot cake from the Prospect mm-hmm. in Westport. This is like a 30 or 40-year-old recipe, but I make it occasionally. It takes 4 hours to make it, but it's just absolutely the best carrot cake ever, and that recipe is out there floating around with some of us old folks.
I agree with you.
Aren't there restaurants that still sell that? That was Bonnie Winston's recipe.
Right.
And I think every once in a while you come across a restaurant that still has it.
I just missed the Prospect years in Westport, and I'm so sad about that because I just hear wonderful things about their food.
It was great.
Well, so if this is such a famous recipe that's circulating among Kansas Cityans, has anyone put it online, or is it being passed
I think
more?
You can find it
you
online.
Could. If you Google Carrot Cake Prospect Kansas City, it will pop up.
Am I correct? Didn't one of the secret ingredients, wasn't it pineapple in that cake?
I don't know. Maybe.
I think it was.
Oh, if it was, not good. So secret anymore, yeah. Charles. Let's talk with Emily in Plattsburgh. Hi, Emily.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about you?
Good. I have a dessert that, unfortunately, the restaurant is no longer in existence, but I figured out how to make it. It is a deep-fried chocolate burrito.
So that sounds like a surprising combination of things.
It is. What you do is you take, it's actually, they use a wonton shell, and you wrap it around your chocolate bar, you know, Hershey's or whatever you prefer. You deep fry that. Then you put it on a plate. You put ice cream, whipped cream, chocolate sauce, and, of course, your cherry on top. And when you cut into that, you get, of course, the creamy, cold ice cream and whipped cream. And then you get into that deep fried burrito part, which is crunchy and gooey and melted chocolate. And it's an incredible combination of texture and flavor that you die for it. It's
okay.
Incredible.
Emily, I'm going to jump in because I want to ask our critics, not specifically about the chocolate burrito, but about this thing that's happening in her description, which is a combination of temperatures. You've got like the cold ice cream and the hot wonton fried and the different textures. Is this part of what we look for in a dessert, or is that a sort of a certain kind of dessert trend, like a moment in desserts maybe?
Well, I think it's just like all dishes in a restaurant. I mean, it's the play of textures. It's the play of temperatures. It's the play of flavors. And so I think desserts are certainly no different. I don't know that I would call it a trend, but there are an awful lot of desserts. I mean, fried ice cream comes to mind, you know, in a Mexican restaurant since we're on the burrito. We're having the atomic burrito discussion.
Can you still find fried ice cream? I haven't seen it in years.
I don't know, but I loved it.
Well, and certainly the classic cold hot is just a typical ice cream sundae with hot fudge sauce.
Well, I was going to say pie a la mode, but
yeah
you're
too.
Right.
Yeah.
Mary, where would you go for a sundae or another frozen ice cream-ish treat?
You know, I've recently discovered the frozen custard at Andy's on Westport Road, and that is, you know, they have mix-ins, and that's really good,
They're
too.
They're out of Springfield, right?
Pardon me?
They're out of Springfield?
Yes.
I think so, yeah.
But I also love Betty Ray's. I mean, they're doing a great job with all their ice cream flavors on Warnell Road.
What do you like about Betty Ray's?
It's a family operation. It's old-fashioned, good ice cream. Their flavors change seasonally and are really well done. The coffee ice cream is made with local Thou Mayest coffee.
Let's talk to Stephanie in Prairie Village. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
What can you share?
Oh, I just was calling because you were mentioning cookies earlier, and I feel like we have to give a shout out to the Classic Cookie because they've been around such a long time and they have awesome cookies.
Those are two good reasons. Mostly the second one. What's so good about them?
Well, my personal favorite is the chocolate chip, and somehow they manage, even when it's not hot, to have it be crispy on the outside and gooey on the inside. So,
oops. Sorry, Stephanie. Gooey on the outside, inside crispy on the outside.
Doesn't sound like a bad combination. You know who else makes really great cookies is Abby Jo at Happy Gillis.
Oh, she does.
Yeah, those
yep,
are
she sure
really
does.
Good.
Let's talk to Mary. Mary's with us from Midtown, Kansas City. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
What are you calling to tell us about?
Oh, I'm calling to discuss the sweet potato pie. The sweet potato pie is very, it's something that we enjoy in the African-American community. And I think that I've been able to order it at the Peachtree Restaurant.
Are you looking for other places to get it in town?
Yes, it'd be nice to know that I could go to other places and get this.
Charles has something to share with us.
You can get a really, really good sweet potato pie at Niecy's on Troost. Mm-hmm. I think it's about 64th and Troost. And I'm allergic to sweet potatoes, so I have to take that pie into a,
grab an EpiPen.
Exactly. I love it though. It's not all that easy to find, but it's a delicious pie.
Anyone else have a sweet potato pie recommendation?
I would think almost any bakery that bakes pies, like Upper Crust, you could maybe. I mean, they might
especially
offer a sweet potato.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a holiday pie.
Yeah, it's definitely holiday pie. So I wouldn't be shy if there's a pie place you like. Ask them if they'll make it.
Can I talk about a holiday pie I miss and I wish somebody would bring back?
Yes.
What's that?
They called it the Mile High Pie at Skye's. It was an ice cream pie with peppermint ice cream and hot fudge sauce.
Oh, that sounds good.
Oh, so good.
I make a variation of that at Christmas time. You can do Oreo cookie
crust
or graham cracker crust, layer it up with different ice creams.
And Jenny, you've got a pie recommendation for us, a banana cream pie.
Right. So this is at Rock Hill Grill, and this was a really unexpected surprise. I'm not a huge banana pie fan. I think the bananas can kind of get mushy, but this is more of a tart and less of a pie. So it's bite-sized, probably 6 bites total, but the crust of the tart is cookie dough. I'm almost positive it's some sort of cookie.
Like a shortbread dough?
No, it's really chewy and soft, like a sugar cookie almost, but it's fluted on the edges, so somebody's clearly put some love into it. And then it's just this light vanilla cream with a little bit of bananas that have been whipped into it, and then lots of whipped cream on top and a little bit of toasted almonds. And it's, like I said, it's small enough to share, but you could literally in 6 bites have it gone. And it was just delicious in terms of the amount of banana flavor it gave. It was very memorable.
Okay, let's hear from Jimmy, who is calling us from Kansas City. And Jimmy, pretty quickly here, tell us about your favorite cookie.
Yeah, it's a pumpkin spice cookie, and they boil the cooking pumpkin instead of baking it, which baked pumpkin is good to put into pies. And then they use clove, cinnamon, and nutmeg. And this is at USA Tomato at 2801 Holmes, and they just started, and it's unbelievable.
So it's a boiled pumpkin in a cookie. For those of you here who bake, what do you think of boiling pumpkin and then putting that in a cookie? That seems a little surprising.
Well, I think it's a texture issue. I mean, if you boiled it, it would have more moisture, obviously, in it. And so it would be more like pumpkin butter, you know, kind of more ploppy. If you bake pumpkin flesh, it tends to get kind of more dried out and stringy. But, you know, obviously you could combine it with all the other wonderful things that are in a pumpkin pie and make it smooth again. So I can see where boiling would be interesting and make for a really moist cookie.
Any other favorite pumpkin desserts since this is pumpkin spice latte season?
Yes, I had one last night. Biz and Wheezy's at 18th in Baltimore is doing a pumpkin spice truffle chocolate. Oh my God, it was fabulous.
Oh, the pumpkin tart at Sasha's.
Oh, it's good too.
Gotta have that.
Oh, and Sasha's. We didn't. I mean, they've got great desserts.
Where is that? Sasha's.
Downtown.
Walnut 9th?
9th and Walnut.
Over by the library. Well,
yep.
Our time is up, but our official list of the best desserts in and around Kansas City will be available at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And I have the feeling that's going to come in handy all fall and winter long. Mary Block, thank you so much for your great recommendations.
My pleasure.
Jenny Vergara, thank you.
Thank you.
And Charles Ferruza, so great seeing you again.
Thank you very much.
I'm already hungry for our next food show. It's the weekend, but you can always enjoy our podcasts. You can subscribe to Central Standard on iTunes or really wherever you get your podcast fix. And talk to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope with interns Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. Linda Scher is our announcer, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.